That was your introduction.
Coming. It is Thursday, November 26th, Thanksgiving Day. The speaker is Rabbi Dr. Bernstein talking about studying Tanakh before there were commentators.
Did you want to hand it?
What's the title on there?
You're asking me?
Yes. This lecture has been given with a variety of titles. So I just was wondering which one I decided to use. What I'd like to think about today and share some marmakomos and so on is an issue that we don't think about too frequently, which is the question of how does biblical commentary develop? I've often said that the Moshe Rabbeinu did not receive a Vilna Shas and a Mikros Gadolos at Sinai, and some of my students are very surprised to hear that. But the notion of interpreting a sacred text, commenting on a sacred text, seems very natural to us. We grow up with commentaries on Torah Shabbat, commentaries on Torah Shabbat, commentaries on the commentaries, super commentaries on the commentaries on the commentaries. And there's obviously a very, very long history to the development of this kind of material. And the first kind of question you want to ask yourself, if you are thinking about this, is both when and why does commentary develop? And in other words, what is the nature of early interpretation, and what is the reason for early interpretation? And when I say early, I mean starting already within Tanakh itself. We'll touch on perhaps an example or two within Tanakh, and then moving down chronologically through the period before Chazal, through some Makaros in Chazal. And I think what we have to realize, and it probably doesn't get thought about, because again, it's part of a historical kind of thinking that is often lacking in some of our educational framework, is that Chazal are our spiritual ancestors. At the same time, they themselves are part of a very broad chain of tradition of Jews who are reading the same sacred texts and interpreting the same sacred texts, but aren't always interpreting them and reading them and following the same practice, actually, as Chazal are. So the same questions that we find bothering the authors of a Midrashic text may very well have bothered the authors of other kinds of commentaries, and perhaps not in commentary form, and that's a very important point, in the centuries before the Common Era. Now, what generates interpretation? So, Tanakh is coming to a close. The last books of Tanakh are being written. Eventually, there are no more books of Tanakh that are being written. And now, the creative impulse moves from writing to interpreting, or from composing to interpreting. And what generates the need for interpretation? Well, sometimes the language is difficult. Over the many hundreds and thousands of years it takes for Tanakh to be put together, language develops. The English of today is not the English of Chaucer, is not the English of Beowulf. And sometimes the word in an early part of Tanakh, a piece of Chumash, might be very difficult. And the meaning may have been forgotten in the course of time, and you have to go back and try to ferret it out. And they don't have quite all the linguistic tools that we have. Usually, the more interpretations you can find suggested for a word, the more likely it is that we don't know what the word really means, and that everybody is doing their best in order to interpret it contextually. Sometimes, there are details in laws, and I'll only talk about one case of law later, but, I mean, if you stop to think and just, if you think about the laws of Shabbos, for example, and you go through all of the passages in Tanakh from Shmos through Nehemiah, that have men, that allude to the laws of Shabbos and what you might not be allowed to do. So if you count out maximally, I still think you don't hit double figures in the number of things that you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. And of course, Shabbos is a very central aspect of Judaism in then as now, and we'll see if we were looking at that, which we won't, we'll see that different groups of Jews have different ways of restricting behavior on Shabbos. Now, when you look at narrative material, stories in Tanakh, you say to yourself that sometimes the Torah or Nach for that matter, leaves out details that you'd like to know. The story is told in a very terse fashion. The story is told without a lot of details, and you wonder what happened in between. What happened between Pasuk Gimel and Pasuk Daled? We need more information. If the story were being told by a contemporary storyteller, we would certainly get more information. And sometimes the gap that is created by the absence of material leads us to ask questions about the behavior of the ancestors of Am Yisrael. Why are they behaving the way they do? Why do they adopt certain modes of behavior that appear to us as if they verge on the not fully moral? And these kinds of issues bother the early interpreters across the board. It doesn't matter whether you are a Prushi or a pre-Prushi, or whether you're one of the Jews that lived at the Dead Sea, or if you're Josephus writing in the first century, writing a summary of Tanakh and retelling the whole story, all of them are bothered by the same questions. And one of the things that makes the study of early biblical interpretation very fascinating is the various ways in which different interpreters coming at the same material will find in order to resolve the dilemmas in the text. Now, in a certain sense, and to anticipate perhaps, yes, this means that on a certain level, I'm going to talk about the Midrashic material as not differing in some way from many of the other approaches to the text that I find in the early interpreters. Now, on a different level, we may indeed privilege the Midrashic material. We shouldn't privilege it necessarily historically, because, the question as to whether it's well known that, the Rambam and others have pointed out that, I'll put it in my terms, it's not one of the Rambam's ikrim that you have to believe that everything that is written in a Midrash actually happened. We'll put it that way. So it's not a question of historicity, but rather it's a question of we may privilege the values of the Midrash, we may privilege the fact that the Midrash belongs to the same tradition that our halakhic system belongs to, and therefore we sort of treat it a little differently. But when you come to look at it as a way of responding to the stimuli within the text, then we might indeed put it, examine it, shall we say, through the same lens as we would examine other material. Let me start with a couple of with the most fundamental level, and a couple of examples of passages where knowing what a word means really would make a big difference in understanding the pasuk. And by the way, not all of these examples were created by me. Obviously, they're all there in the ancient sources, but I've stolen from a variety of good collections of this material. Some of them are my own examples, but I didn't gather them all myself. And they appear in a variety of works on early biblical interpretation. And one of them is a passage that we'll read in a few weeks. Vayikru lefanav avreich with Yosef. Now, the word avreich doesn't occur anyplace else. We don't know what the word means. And the way you can tell is by looking at all of the ancient sources. Now, what are they doing? They're looking at the context, and they're saying, okay, what does this word seem to mean in the context? And here I should note that the first level of interpretation, or the first level of commentary, is going to be in the early translations. So whether it's the translation into Greek that was done in the 3rd century before the Common Era, or the various forms of the Aramaic Targumim that are part of the rabbinic tradition, or in the translation into Latin that was done by Jerome, who had access to his Jewish rabbinic sources. The translations are a very basic level of interpretation, because every translation, of course, is commentary, especially when it comes to words whose meaning you don't know. So both the Greek translation and the Vulgate, the Latin translation, translate a herald proclaimed before him. Well, what is Kore Lefanav? It must be somebody who was a caller, a proclaimer. Okay, well, we're going to guess that that's the word herald. Makes sense in context. Word probably doesn't mean that, but it's a good try. Right? The Book of Jubilees, which we'll mention probably more than once again, the Book of Jubilees is a book that was written in the middle of the 2nd century BCE, right around the time of the Maccabees of the Hasmonean Rebellion. And the Book of Jubilees, which survives today only in Ethiopic, but we actually have lots of fragments of it in Hebrew, the Hebrew original from Qumran among the Dead Sea Scrolls. And this is a book which retells the stories of Bereshit. It's a really interesting book. Retells the stories of Bereshit, plugging in what we would call the Agadata, plugging in the Medrash, or the stories. Sometimes it's Midrash with a small M, right? Midrash means all of these things that are added to the narrative. We'll think of a capital M. If I talk of Bereshit Rabba, put a capital on the word Midrash. Otherwise, it would be a small M. And what's interesting about the Book of Jubilees, it's written from a particular legal perspective. It's written from the perspective of the Jews who lived there at the Dead Sea, in that Dead Sea settlement, perhaps related, according to my good friend Larry Schiffman, to the Tzedukim, and certainly the halacha that they observe in the Dead Sea Scrolls resembles what we know of Tzeduki halacha. So you read it and you look about the Avos keeping halacha, they're keeping not our halacha, but they're keeping a much more stringent form of halacha. You should be very happy, by the way, that Chazal won, in the end. The Chazal gets picked on as the Mechilim of antiquity. The history is always written by the victors, and therefore we're right. But, the fact is that the Book of Jubilees reflects a much more halacha l'chumra than does our halacha. But here we're talking about the translation of a simple sentence, and they translate it, and they called before him God and the Mighty One of God. So Avrek now becomes a quotation. And it looks like they interpret it as if it's related to the Hebrew word abir, which means powerful, and that's another very good guess, but of course, probably doesn't mean what the text means. I don't know what the text means, actually. Aquila, one of the minor Greek translators in Jerome and another work, writes, Ben-Veni, as if it's from the Hebrew word berach, to genuflect, to bend the knee, bow down. And that's not a bad guess, except the word abrech is probably Egyptian, not Hebrew. But if it were a Hebrew word, that would actually be a very, very good interpretation. But the two most interesting interpretations, and this goes to show you how the imaginative creativity of the early translators and Mefarshim can go. Targum Onkelos translates Dein Abba de Malka. This is the father of the king. How in the world does Avrech mean father of the king? Well, Av means father, that much we know. And the Latin word Rex means king. So Onkelos has done what Chazal do now and then in a variety of midrashic contexts, which is to take a word, break it into two words, and go look for the source of the word, not just in Hebrew, but other languages as well. You may remember the etymology of the Tosafos that you find quoted by Chazal. I think it's quoted by Rashi and Chumash as well, that it's made up of two different words in two different languages, and it means whatever it means. So, Abba de Malka, new translation. Again, very unlikely that that's what the word means, but it's a good try. And finally, Bereshis Rabbah, and it's found in some of the other Targumim as well. The Bereshis Rabbah translates, again, breaking it up into two, Av b'chachma b'rach v'shanim. Now you know why an Avrek in a Kotel is called an Avrek. That's the reason. I mean, you always wondered why they always ask you for money for the Avrekim in the Kotel. This is why. Because an Avrek is Av b'chachma b'rach v'shanim. So what you see by looking at all of these, and as I said, I don't know what the word means. It's probably an Egyptian word. Maybe it means bow down. Who knows? But a translator can't leave a blank space. You can't write, in antiquity, you couldn't write a marginal note that said, text corrupt, we don't know what it means, right? You have to translate. Your audience needs to know what it means.
You said,
so,
why not?
Because you couldn't. Right, you didn't. You didn't. Right, it wasn't method. The method didn't let you do it. Right, the method said you have to put something there. You do your best. You give it your best try, and you go on. So on the one hand, we understand why the translations are doing what they're doing. On the other hand, when we look at the Mefarshim, such as in Gracious Rabbah, then you see that Chazal sometimes take the opportunity, on the one hand, to take something which is difficult and to turn it into something else. In other words, you gain by your ability not to have to translate, because I don't know what it means, but I get to make the word mean something. And I get to say something through my translation of this impossible term. Okay, this was one nice little example where you see how many options you have. And as I said, the more options you have, the less likely it is that the word actually means one of them. Now let's take a look at a different example with a word, and here's a word that we do know the meaning of. But we can't tell what the meaning of the word is in the sentence because of the syntax isn't clear. Remember, I'm going to stress this, the idea of a commentary, that is to say, you write down the Dibur HaMatchil, you write down the lemma, and then you write what you think the phrase means or what the sentence means, doesn't exist in antiquity. You don't have commentaries. The earliest commentaries that you have, and we may have one here at Dead Sea Scrolls perhaps, the earliest systematic commentaries that we knew of before the scrolls were discovered were Philo in the first century BCE in Egypt. The commentaries of the early church fathers in the, let's say, 2nd, 3rd century, and a little bit later, the Midrash Halacha and Midrash Agada, Lahavdil of Chazal. So, the idea of commentary, by the way, if you wanted to write out a story and explain what you thought the story meant, the only way to do it was to rewrite the entire story and embed your interpretation into the retelling. You waste an awful lot of parchment. In other words, the idea of focusing on the part that needs explanation and writing that out separately was an idea whose time had not yet come. And whoever thought of that, probably saved the lives of many animals. But in except today when unfortunately we just keep printing things. But the problem is that they hadn't worked out the commentary form. So rewriting the story with your explanation built into it was in antiquity one of the only two things you could do in the early antiquity. You could either translate it or you could rewrite it. But you didn't have the luxury of what we call the commentary, where if I only have five comments to make in the perek, I should make those five comments and then go on. That form hadn't yet been created. So here I have the pasuk with Kayin, where God says to Kayin, lama charalach v'lama naflu fanecha, haloim teitiv se'et, v'imlo teitiv lafetach hatat roveitz. So if you do well, se'et. Well, the Hebrew word nasa, from which se'et comes, has a whole variety of meanings. And you can see that the early interpreters struggle. What does this word se'et mean in that context? So the Greek translation says, im teitiv se'et, if you make an offering correctly. Se'et, perhaps, as if in se'et mincha or something like that, to make an offering, to lift up an offering. And they understand as if there's an object there. And, okay, if you bring the right kind of offering, then, you will be treated well or something like that. On the other hand, Bracious Rabbah, several of the minor Greek translations, the Syriac translation, and the Latin all translate, if you do well in teitiv, comma, se'et, you receive a reward. Like either se'et panim or something like that. In other words, you have to decide which of the various idioms of nasa is operative here in order to understand what the pasuk means. And again, if you look at your translations through the ages, English and others, you'll see that there is far from agreement as to what this might mean. And finally, the Eretz Yisrael Targumim, that is to say, Yerushalmi and that whole family, Targum Yerushalmi and others, all translate, your sins will be forgiven. If you do well, your sins will be forgiven. Because we also know that nun sin aleph has the meaning, no say alone, to forgive sins. So, if you do well, then your sins will be forgiven. So, once again, a very small example. We know what word it is. It's not like it's an unusual word or rare word. It's actually a very common word, and that's what creates the problem. And in antiquity already, there is a complete absence of agreement as to what this word might mean.
Question?
Yeah, please.
How does the fact that the Talmud don't...
Some of the time, the Ta'amim are part of the interpretive system of Chazal, of the Bali Masorah, and you would tend to privilege an interpretation which puts Se'et with Haloim Teitiv, so probably the Septuagint would not make it on those grounds, but either of the second two is possible. And of course, who's to say that at every point in antiquity, in every place, the Tameh HaMikra, or the reading tradition of where to punctuate, was equally well known, but that's certainly a very good pointer. Now, another area which demands interpretation is seeming contradiction. And we're going to take two examples of it, one which you don't need a calculator for and one which you do. So let's take the one that you don't need a calculator for first. And it's a very famous example, actually. In Shmos, it says that you may not eat of the Karban Pesach, na uvashel mevushel b'mayim kiyim tzliyesh. You must eat it fire-roasted rather than cooked in water. But in Dvarim, it says, uvishalta v'achalta b'makom ashiyachar Hashem Elokecha bo. You are to cook it and eat it. That creates a contradiction, right? What is the difference between, you could say Pesach Mitzrayim had one halacha and Pesach Doros has another halacha. Okay, that would be a way to respond. Shmos is talking about Pesach Mitzrayim, Dvarim is talking about Pesach Doros. That is certainly not the way Chazal interpret, and it's also not the way Tanakh interprets. Because here we have an example where within Tanakh itself it's crystal clear that the author of Divrei Hayamim is responding to the seeming contradiction between the Psukim in Dvarim and in Shmos. And in describing the Pesach at the time of Chizkiyahu, Divrei Hayamim writes, Vayivashlu es ha-Pesach bo'esh kamishpat. They cooked the Karban Pesach in fire according to the law. Right? If I could use rabbinic language in the mouth of the author of Divrei Hayamim, Bishul Ba'esh Nami Mikrei Bishul. Cooking in fire is also called cooking. But it's clear, the language of Divrei Hayamim is peculiar. And it's quite obvious that Divrei Hayamim writes what it does only because there's a sensitivity to the sphere between Shmos and Dvarim. Yeah, go ahead.
We have a lot of places where a word had a general meaning. And
you, the problem is, you say you don't do bishul, but you do tzli. So if you look at Shmos, bishul and tzli are antithetical. So it's pretty clear, and then you do have uvishalta in Dvarim.
Second time around, it's a
the question becomes. So what you're doing is you're doing the exact same thing as Divrei Hayamim did. I'm going to say it's not so easy to claim that you have these global versus non-global meanings. I think you'd have to look at each one individually and think about what's going on. Yeah, so this is a fairly famous example where Tanakh itself, I think Chazal actually referred to the pasuk in Divrei Hayamim somewhere, point out that there is a resolution, and this is in a certain sense what we call Ashiyama Kotzim Ashlishi V'Achriya Beinayim, that there is a resolution. The second problem, and this is one of my favorites, to the degree that I remember when I saw the Dead Sea Scroll text that I think there's a resolution to this, I started jumping up and down in the library and screaming at one of my colleagues and saying, you see what he's doing? You know, then I explained to him and said, okay, I see why you're so excited. But still, we all know the famous problem, and every kid that learns Rosh Chodesh and Rashi, Parshas Lech Lecha, knows it. Abram, the blessed says, is 75 years old when he leaves Haran. Right? Now, Kodesh Baruch Hu says to Abram later on in the Bris Ben Absarim, that Yodoa Kedaki Geryez Arachav Eretz Lolohem Babadumi Nuo Samar Bameyos Shana. The Hebrew is right there. Right? They're going to be slaves for 400 years. And we all know very well that we count 400 years from when? No, from the birth of Yitzchak. Thank you. We count 430 from the birth of 400 from the birth of Yitzchak. The other pasuk says in Shmos, Moshe ben Yisrael shesh ruv Mitzrayim, Shoshim shana v'arba meyot shana, 430 years. Okay, so now I have 400 on the one hand, which Chazal counts from the birth of Yitzchak, but now what do I do with this 430 number? So, according to Chazal, I count from when? From the Bris Ben Absarim. But that now raises a problem. Because if we count from the Bris Ben Absarim, which takes place where in Eretz Yisrael, but the Pasuk said that Avram went to Eretz Yisrael when he was how old? 75. So the Bris Ben Absarim must have taken place if Yitzchak was born when Avram was 100. Bris Ben Absarim must have happened when Avram was 70. So number one, the Bris Ben Absarim is out of order, a Mokdam Mukhar. And number two, we aren't told that Avram makes a pilot trip before he makes Aliyah, that he goes 5 years earlier to see if he likes it. And that's when the Bris Ben Absarim happens. And he goes back to Haran, and then he goes back to Eretz Yisrael. The Torah doesn't tell us any of that. So as I said, that is the rabbinic answer. And by the way, in the second page, you'll see in Seder Olam Rabbah, that is the way the story is told. Now, Josephus tells the story, you know, and he is, just to show you, he is completely mitalem from the problem. He doesn't even notice it. He says, Avram, that 430 years after Avram came to Canaan, they leave. He is, apparently is not paying close attention because he's writing his narrative of the history. He doesn't have his text in front of him. His reader doesn't have the text. He can simply ignore the contradiction. He just says 430 years. He knows the pasuk in, because he's talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim, so, and this is Josephus, the historian, former participant in the rebellion against Rome, who somehow survived, yeah, whatever the story is, and he writes in Rome, he's writing a history, he's rewriting the whole history of Tanakh in the first 11 books of the Jewish antiquities in Greek, and he's highlighting positive things about Am Yisrael for his, he's writing for a non-Jewish audience primarily. And he doesn't, if these people don't have texts, he just writes it, he doesn't worry about the sphira, he doesn't have to answer it. Chazal, on the other hand, knows that you've got a Chumash Breishis, you've got a Chumash Shmos. You know, I heard Kriyas HaTorah 1 week, I'm going to hear Kriyas HaTorah again, I've got to deal with it. So Chazal, as I said in Seder Olam, as you see the text very, very clearly, resolves it the way Rashi does. What's fascinating is this text that we call Genesis Commentary 8 in Qumran, which I think... my view has not been completely accepted yet, but we're working on it. That this is one of the first attempts to write what we would call a pshat commentary. It's a text which goes piece by piece. It doesn't go straight through the narrative. It makes comments on individual passages, and in most cases is resolving what I would call a pshat commentary. But that's neither here nor there. Let's just look at the specific case. Now here you have the text, the Hebrew text. The brackets are what's not there in the manuscript. There are a little bit that has to be filled in. Likewise in the translation. And it hinges on the following. Gracious tells us that Terach leaves, that Terach has Avram when he's 70 years old. And they move at some point from Ur Kasdim to Haran. Okay. Torah doesn't tell us when they moved. Let's read the Dead Sea Scroll text. Ben me'av arba'im shana tarach b'tzei so me'ur kastim v'yavol charan v'avram ben shivim shana v'chamesh shanim yashav avram b'charan v'achar yasav avram l'eretz kanan shishim shana meit tarach. I'm certain of all the restorations here, as certain as anybody can be of filling anything in with it when there are holes in the text. The important point, however, is why pick on the date for Terach to leave Ur Kasdim when Avram, when he is 140 and Avram is 70? And they live 5 years in Haran. Just happens to be. I read this text and I said,
My God, he's and I don't see why I got excited. He's answering the 400-430 problem without even mentioning it. In other words, he's saying, oh yeah, Avram started leaving home when he was 70. We can count 430 from then. In fact, the other thing implicitly is if you make that calculation, it means that he also has the tradition of counting 400 from the birth of Yitzchak, which is not the Farish of the Pasuk any place. So you see, if my analysis is correct, that here Chazal and this other non-rabbinic, pre-rabbinic commentary share the common tradition or interpretive tradition that we count 400 years Shibud Mitzrayim from the birth of Yitzchak. That's not in the text anywhere, but here I have, I'm going to call a, quote, confirmation of the antiquity of the rabbinic tradition in a different kind of text, which actually solves the primary problem in a very different way. So on the one hand, we have a support to the rabbinic tradition of counting 400 from the birth of Yitzchak, and the other hand, we have a much simpler tradition that doesn't require a pilot trip, as I called it, for Avram to go to Eretz Yisrael at an earlier stage of his life. And here, in our kind of context, I'm going to tell you two really sort of interesting things. This interpretation that Avram leads Ur Kasdim when he's 70, I'm deviating from early interpretation, I'm going to the Middle Ages very quickly. Avram leads Ur Kasdim when he's 70 and goes to Charan, reappears in the Middle Ages in three Mefarshim, in Rav Sadia Gaon, Ibn Ezra, and in Rav Yosef Bechor Shor. Popping up out of nowhere, I have my suspicion, I'm wondering why they should be the three to pick it up, and I have a theory about it which I haven't been able to chase down. But that's not the amazing part. If you read the Vilna Gaon's notes on Seder Olam Rabbah, he says, on this comment, he says, nah, that's not what happened. What Chazal are writing Seder Olam Rabbah is not the right explanation. Okay, the Gaon just throws it out, right? The Gaon says, V'hanachon k'nisav b'midrash, the correct interpretation as we find in Midrash, that Avram leaves Ur Kasdim when he's 70 years old, and we count from that. Greater people than I have looked for that Midrash and haven't found it. What the Gaon is talking about, nobody knows, and I guarantee you we never read the Dead Sea Scrolls. And he wouldn't have called it a Midrash either. But what's really remarkable is, you know, the Gaon either thought he saw or created the very same interpretation. So what you have here is an alternate Pshuto Shel Mikra approach to the problem of how do you resolve 400-430 in this fragmentary Dead Sea Scroll text, which, as I said, happens to pop up again in the Middle Ages in three of the classical Mefarshim. Okay. Now let's take a different kind of problem. The question of gaps in the text and the questions that are raised by the gaps in the text. And we'll see several different kinds. One of the most famous examples, of course, is Kayin says to Hevel, the pasuk after the one that we saw earlier, right? He says, "Vayomer Kayin el Hevel Achiv, Vahibi Osam Basadeh," and so on and so forth. What did he say? Vayomer is usually followed by a quotation. Vayomer doesn't have to be, but Vayomer is. Where is what he said? And why did he kill him? So that is a really easy question to ask, and it's an obvious one. And here, there is an attempt to answer it, and again, it's a midrashic attempt, and here we're in Chazal's time, in the Eretz Yisrael Targum, it's in Targum Yerushalmi, and the other representatives of the Eretz Yisrael translation tradition, that's the non-uncleist tradition, and here we have a very long citation, a very long dialogue between Kayin and Hevel. So let's just look at it, and you'll notice at the beginning and end, you have underlined the actual translation of the pasuk, and all the rest of it is not there in the pasuk. Right? Kayin gets up, and he says, let's go out to the field. So that solves problem number one. What did he say? Let's go out to the field. Now those words, let's go out to the field, are actually also found in the Greek. They're found in the Syriac. In other words, as if it's part of the biblical text. many scholars have thought that indeed the words Netzei HaSadeh really should be in the biblical text. You can make a very good non-dogmatic argument for the Masoretic text being correct and the other being a gap filler. In other words, you have to fill out the text. So the text, just like a translation, the text also sort of has to fill out what was there. So they put in the most reasonable words, Netzei HaSadeh. I don't want to spend time on the back and forth of why I think that the Masoretic text is anything else you couldn't would be puzzled to read in shul anyway. But it is very likely that this is a guess making an attempt to fill in the gap rather than what the text actually had. But that is the first part that solves the what did he say problem. But still. What happened? And then he goes, and there's another answer. What did he say? They went out to the field and had another conversation. And the conversation in the field is about Schar Va'onesh. Cain says, Les Din V'les Dayan V'les Alma Da'atzei. And everything is arbitrary. There's no justice. Everything is just as it happens. Hevel says, no, there is judgment. There is a judge. There is another world. There is a Schar Va'onesh. There is mercy, there's rachamim, and so on. But there's also masim tovim, and because my korban was nicer than yours, was offered more properly than yours, whatever, it was accepted. And as a result of that argument, Kayin gets up and kills Hevel. So now we have a theological argument. Hevel, of course, is a good guy. Kayin is a bad guy. What has happened here? The Bala Midrash here, and it's a targum, but I'm going to call it a Midrash because you just as easily could find this dialogue taking place in Bereshit Rabba as you do here. What has happened? He's taken two theological positions, and he's put the position that he holds in the mouth of Hevel. He's put some other position, and I really would like to know which Jewish group he is attacking by putting that argument in the mouth of Kayin. We can't be sure. Could it be is some group that didn't believe in Schar Va'onesh or some group that didn't believe in Olam Haba? I could just randomly call it Tzeduki, but that would be irresponsible because I don't know whether that's the case at the time of this particular paragraph. But what I have here is I have two positions set up antithetically. Notice what's happened here. Biblical interpretation here has gone beyond being interpretation of the Bible and has moved to being an expression of the values of the interpreter. In other words, the Mitorgamon, the Mefaresh, has told us what he believes by putting it in the mouth of Hevel, and he's told us about a view that he rejects by putting it in the mouth of Kayin. Do we have to think that he really thought that debate went on between Kayin and Hevel? I don't think so. But this is part of Targum Beveis HaKnesses, which is an educational phenomenon. He's teaching his tzibur. He's teaching his listening audience at the point where they got to Kayin and Hevel. The Targumon recited this little debate, and his audience presumably is supposed to learn from this that you're supposed to believe in Schar Va'onesh, you're supposed to believe in Olam Haba, and that those people who don't hold that way are just like Kayin. So we might not call that, that's eisegesis, not exegesis, as we say. It's reading into the text, not reading out of the text. But nevertheless, that is one of the fundamental aspects of biblical interpretation in antiquity. Now, another example of a question that you all might have had, and we all would often ask, when Noach wakes up, on page 3, and when Noach wakes up and curses Canaan, you wonder, wait a minute, what did Canaan do? Right? It says, Vayarchon avi Canaan eser vas, achid. What did Canaan did something? Canaan didn't do anything. And he curses Canaan. And here I have a remarkable confluence of that same Dead Sea Scroll text that I mentioned before, and a text in Bereishis Rabba, which is probably written about 600 years later. The Qumran text says, "V'lo ki le'el eschom ki'im v'no ki be'rach el es b'nei Noach." Earlier in the parsha, it says, "V'yivarech Elohim es Noach nes b'no." Noach knows my son Chum was included in that bracha. So what good is it going to be if you give a curse to Chum? So I'm going to have to curse Canaan. The Bereishis Rabba text says, "Chum chote u'Canaan miskalel atzmeha." Ella, Nimai Dixiv, Vayvarach Elohim Es Noach Ves Bonav, Ein Kol Avim Kam Bracha. Both texts find the answer to why does Chum avoid the curse and Tan get cursed in the fact that Noach's sons were already the recipients of divine blessing. And as a result, the imposition of a curse by Noach would not have done any good. And here I want to ask myself, is Chazal's interpretation here part of a dotted line that goes back to the Dead Sea Scroll text? Did everybody in Bayit Sheni know about this interpretation, and that's why it reflects itself in Chazal? Or, and I'm always worried about the or, this interpretation is based on a close reading of the Pesukim, of noticing it says, Vayivarech Elohim es Noach ves Banav. So two separate, sensitive, Pshuto Shel Mikra readers could come up with the same reading. So as much as I'd like to say what I have here is a pan-Jewish reading of this particular parsha, both in Chazal and in the earlier text from Qumran, I can't do it. See, in a case where there's, this is the irony, when you have an outlandish interpretation in two places, so then you can link them, because you can say, you know, it's much less likely that two strange interpretations, a strange interpretation is going to be invented independently by two interpreters. But when I have a pshat reading that's shared by two interpreters, it's much more difficult to make that assertion, even though I'm not absolutely sure. Yeah.
In the previous one, we talked about Kayin and the Targum.
Yeah.
Is this really a perush on this pasuk, or is it a perush on what you did on the first page?
Well, it's real, okay. I think the psukim are linked because they're consecutive psukim, but it's definitely part of the. It's placed in the mouths of Kayin and Hevel as a debate in the field. So it's the Targum locates it in Pasuk Ches. Whether it is also, and I think you're correct, whether we see from here perhaps what the author of that thought was going on in Pasuk Zayin, when God says to Kayin, hello, and Kayin, and let's say, and lo, say, give a Pesach, Asas, Rovetz. And now from Kayin's comments here, we see what's happening there. That could very well be the case. But the fact is that in the way it's formulated, it's put in these two speeches are put in their mouths as a debate here in Pasuk Ches, not in Pasuk Zion. So, from a formal standpoint, it's made to look like what did I think was happening in Pasuk Ches, even though I think theologically there is probably a connection with back to Pasuk Zion as well. I think that's absolutely right. Now I'd like to think about a story that we all know, and talk about a little, you know, a bit at length. And that is, again, an example that's used by many students of early interpretation, and that's the story of Abram and Sarai in Egypt. And that story, which is very brief, the story is 10 sukkim or so altogether. Maybe fewer, but it's about 10. Yeah, I think it's 11, actually. The Torah here leaves out a lot of detail. The story is told in a very sketchy fashion. And some of the details are troublesome. Like, they're going into Egypt, and Abram says, and he makes up this scenario that, the Egyptians are going to see you, they're going to want to kill me, tell them you're my sister. Why? Why does Abram Avinu behave in an amoral fashion, or what appears to us to be an amoral fashion? What reason does he have for thinking that this is an appropriate mode of behavior? They have something to be afraid of. Now, what's very interesting is the story, when he tells the story, the Torah tells the story of Avram's adventure with Avimelech later on in Perek Chof, the second time, it mentions that back at the beginning of the wanderings, I said to Sarai, wherever we go, say that I'm your brother. The Torah doesn't say that any place earlier, right? The Torah back any doesn't say that this happened. So again, that raises a different kind of question, which we know very well, because the Torah doesn't have to tell us everything twice. But nevertheless, it makes you sit up and wonder. So I'm going to go backwards. We'll work from the later sources on back. Let's start with the Chazal, which is the last source on the page. Chazal and Bereishis Rabbah say, Avram says to Sarai, we are entering a place of repulsive and dark people. Please say you are my sister so that it would go well with me because of you. So according to Bereishis Rabbah, Chazal and Avram knows that these, and Chazal's position here is one that we would term racist, but okay, that's not my problem for the moment. Say these people are known to be to be dangerous. They are shchorim, mecholarim u'shchorim, and they are somehow going. I know that you're going to be in danger, that I'm going to be in danger, and therefore this is what you should do. Right? It is an instinctive response to entering into this very other land where there is something to be afraid of. And that's the whole explanation that Chazal seemed to give. And if you look in Josephus, only a little bit before Chazal, Josephus is writing in the first century CE, he actually writes something very similar. Fearing the Egyptians' frenzy for women, is afraid the king will slay him, and he devises the plan. In other words, I know that these Egyptians are lustful, and Josephus actually picks up the same idea later on again when he talks about throwing the boys into the Nile and preserving the girls. He uses the same theme there also. The Egyptians are a lustful culture, and therefore they are going to take you away, they're going to kill me. So in both of those cases, both Chazal and Josephus have very similar responses to the gap in the text that says, why does Avram tell Sarai to do this? A text from Qumran, a very interesting text that I spent a good deal of my time on in recent years, which is it's an Aramaic narrative from Qumran. It's not a Targum, it's a story in Aramaic. It's called Genesis Apocrypha. It's not a very good name. The original Israeli editors called it Megillah Chitzonit L'Bereishit. It's a retelling of the narrative of Bereishis with stuff stuck in. And as they're about to enter Egypt, Avram has a dream. And he sees in his dream there's a cedar tree and a palm tree, and they want to uproot the cedar, leave the palm alone. The palm screams out, don't do it, we're related to each other. He wakes up, he tells the dream to his wife, and he tells her the dream and the interpretation and says, they're going to try to kill me, and this is what I want you to do wherever we go. Say I'm my brother, and I will live because of you. So parenthetically, notice he's actually taken the language from the Abimelech passage. This is what I said to her back then, and he actually plugs it in here. So there is a place that he said it earlier, namely here. And that's actually typical of certain Bayis Sheni sources to, if something is mentioned as having happened, they write it back into their Torah even, and say it has to have happened. But that's a small point. The important point is that Avram has had a message that something bad is going to happen. Namely, he's had a dream, a prophetic dream. This is this incident that of which I say, if I had read this in a real midrash, I wouldn't be surprised at all. The night before they entered Egypt, Avram has his dream, a prophetic dream, and that's how he knows. It's exactly the kind of interpretation that I might find elsewhere in Chazal to explain why he behaves in a certain fashion. By the way, the symbolism of the dream, of course, is a symbolism which I will find in Chazal as well. What's it based on? No, that's much too clever.
Sorry.
Which in some later Midrashim is actually referred to Avram and Sarah. Now there are Midrashim that say that Avram is the Erez and Sarah is the Tamar, which is what you get here. Again, that's a commonplace kind of interpretation, so I suspect it may not be a linked tradition. But it's clear that that's the sort of the text that underlies the language of the Midrash, of the Apocryphon here, is the text in Tehillim. But what's important is that the Genesis Apocryphon has gone further than any of the other early sources, more than Chazal and more than Josephus, in justifying, if I may use that term, Avram's behavior by saying he had a vision which told him that he should be afraid. And there, and by the way, even what are the palm trees saying now? Don't cut down the cedar tree because we come from the same family. So even the dream itself gave him a pointer in terms of what he was going to tell Sarai to say. So the problem of the amorality has been put aside. In other words, the avos, not just for Chazal, but for other early Jewish sources, have to be as sin-free as possible. And in effect, what you're doing in by looking for this, by inserting this into the narrative, is to say, I don't think that Avram Gassam was doing something wrong. He had a reason for it. Yeah, Seymour.
Also, it's interesting that both Yitzchak and Yaakov, in fact, have dreams on the threshold of going into Egypt. So it sort of completes the picture. Right?
Very interesting. I have to think, that's just, because Yitzchak never goes in.
Right.
Right. And Yaakov does also. And you know what? If you're right, I'm going to steal that idea. By the way, this is why you give lectures like this, because every so often somebody tells you something you haven't thought of yet. I thank you very much. That's a very good he'ara. Because what the narrator is doing is creating further parallels among the avos, which is not surprising at all. This is not part of this talk, but I can show you other places where, or in this very story, there are links that are created between different parts of the narrative of the avos, but that's a very nice example. That's very good. Go ahead. Yeah.
So when Chazal, forget exactly where the Gemara is, but the Chazal and the Chazal and the that's very similar. Is that
The notion of looking for ways to vindicate the ancestors of Am Yisrael is not unique to Chazal, yes. And I don't think you need that formulation in the Gemara. What you're saying is, we don't want the people that are the paragons of virtue and the paradigms for our existence to have been sinners. Now, you know very well that you know, we can go too far with that. By the way, I'll mention the fact that we know that there is one view in Chazal, it's a Das Yachid, that Avram kept all the mitzvahs. Right? I find the same theme all through the Book of Jubilees, that the avos are keeping mitzvahs. They're the first ones to do this mitzvah, the first ones to do that mitzvah. So the notion that they too behave like regular Jews is something which is also not unique to Chazal, but is part of a much older tradition. But those two, would I say, would belong to the same family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You probably mentioned this earlier, but when you say Chazal, I assume you're referring to Bereishis Rabbah.
I'm using Chazal. Wherever I can use Bereishis Rabbah, I would use Bereishis Rabbah because it's the earliest of the Midrashei Agada. But it could be later also, it could be in Gemara's also.
And you may have covered this earlier, but can you talk about the time frame between
the two sources? Yeah. Genesis Apocryphon is probably late 2nd, 1st century BCE. Josephus is late 1st century CE. Bereishis Rabbah, thank you, I should have said this earlier. I didn't. Bereishis Rabbah is composed 5th century CE. So you see there is a gap there. Now, what is the other question you want to know? Well, how long is Sarai in Paro's palace? Did anything happen to Sarai in Paro's palace? And who told Paro that he had the wife? Right? So, these issues are dealt with in the ancient sources as well. Again, this is what I call gap filling, because you have a question. It's not there in the text. Let's fill it in. So, first of all, the Genesis Apocryphon, right, BCE, writes, during that night, the Most High God sent a spirit to plague him, an evil spirit in all his household. He was unable to approach her, and although he was with her for 2 years, he did not know her. So, first of all, what does the Pasuk say? I should have told you what the Pasuk says. Negaim Gedolim, Karoves Beitov, Negaim, I think I may have gotten wrong, but Negaim Gedolim, Karoves Beitov, Alvar Sarayi, Shisabram. Doesn't say how long she's there. Right? So the reason it's 2 years here has to do with the chronology of this work, which is worked out. There is a chronology. But notice the plague is based on the Pasuk, Negaim Gedolim Bas Beitov. He was unable to approach her is borrowed from the Abimelech narrative. Vavimelech lo korave leha. There the Torah told us explicitly. The author of the Apocryphon doesn't want you to think that Paro got to do his dastardly deed. The aim ha'uma is pure. Paro doesn't get to go over there. Gone. Right? But it's 2 years. It's he was unable to approach her, and I don't have it here, but how does he find out? One of his nobles goes to Lot, to ask Avram to pray for him, like Abimelech, right? Right? And Lot says, what do you mean, pray for him? He's got my uncle's wife. What? Okay, that's how it works there. Josephus, filling the same gap. The king wanted to see her, was about to lay hands on her, piano music in the background, but God thwarted his criminal passion by an outbreak of disease and political disturbance, right? Just happened to happen. And when he had sacrifices offered to discover a remedy, the priest said, huh, you know why this is all happening? You've got the stranger's wife. So it doesn't tell us how long. It does tell us how he found out. His priests, his diviners figured it out. And it tells us that he was unable to approach her because there was political disturbance and sickness in the country. Chazal, and Chazal don't tell you here, but how long is she, according to Chazal, how long is Sarai in Pharaoh's house? Anybody remember? One night. All right? Big difference in the Genesis Apocrypha in 2 years. Yeah.
Another question is the strategy working, and is that a solution? So he doesn't have to be killed, but is this a proper way to avoid being killed?
Well, that's an interesting question, but nobody seems to think about that because that's not part of the, that's not a hole in the story that you have to fill. This is what, my the haba, the story happened.
Part of the morality issue.
No, the morality. What does he do? Oh, okay, there's a long prayer after she's taken in the Genesis Apocryphon. He turns to God, and says, you are the, Rosh Shalom, b'chule, do not let Pharaoh outrage my wife, let him know that you are powerful over all, b'chule. Yes, so Avram prays at the appropriate moment, and if we were reading that text straight through, I would have made a big deal about it, because it's important. But what do I have in Chazal? I have a machlokas in Chazal here. Reish Lakish says Paro got a severe form of leprosy. Rashi says it's something that prevented his sexual activity. Shatash mishkoshelo, Rashi quotes. And Reb Levi says a different view. All night the angel is standing there with a whip. If she said strike, he would strike. If she said hold back, he would hold back. So first of all, you have to see the beautiful subtlety of the second midrash. Why? What does Sarai have to do with striking and not striking? Based on the words, al devar Sarai eishes Avram. Al-Dvar doesn't mean because of, it means at the command of, according to the Midrash. So right, again, that is a classic Midrashic reading, where it takes the words of the text and turns it a little bit, and now, of course, you have a scene where Sarai is saying, hit or don't hit. So the Nega'im Gedolim are either something natural, a physical sickness, or something supernatural, an angel striking at the command of Sarai. And of course, here, Chazal don't have an independent way of informing. He gives her back the next day, and it goes on from there. But again, you see, both on the entry and on the exit points of this narrative, we have attempts by these three early forms of interpretation to respond to the paucity of information in the biblical text, and to try to flesh the story out in ways which, on the one hand, are similar, and on the other hand, are different. For the last example of what I'll call gap filling, and I'll just touch this with very, very quickly, what is wrong with the Book of Esther? We all know. What's wrong with the Book of Esther? No God.
right? At the very, it's a book. It's the book is as wine, women, and the Persian court. That's what the book is all about, right? It is not a very firm book. And what's very striking is that both in the Greek translation tradition and in the Aramaic translation tradition, there are attempts made to bring the book into line with what you'd expect the Book of Tanakh should look like. So you, at the very same point, what I call frumming up the story, at the very same point, before Esther is about to go into the king in Perek Hay, what does a Jew do based Sarah? A Jew prays. There's no prayer in Esther. Both the Septuagint, which is the first text, and the Targum on Esther, which is a very late Targum, probably 7th, 8th century, at the same point in time, put a prayer into the mouth of Esther as she's about to go in. And the one in the Greek is particularly fascinating, because she says, you know I can't stand the wicked, I abhor the bed of the uncircumcised and any alien, I don't like my crown, I only wear it publicly, I don't eat at Haman's table, I have not honored the king's feast or drunk the wine of his libations, I have to sleep with him, but I don't eat his food. And put aside the Gemara and Sanhedrin, by about Esther. But the point is, what is this saying? She's saying, I am behaving as much like a Jew as I'm supposed to behave. I'm not this crypto-Jew who lives in the king's palace and I'm completely assimilated and I'm, doing all these wrong things and I'm all of a sudden turning to you for help. No. All my life, says Esther, I have been behaving, even at Achashverosh's home, I am behaving the way you expect me to. I can't stand my situation here, and you are the only one who's going to save us. And the tefillah that she recites, exactly the tefillah you expect a Jew to recite. Yeah.
Maybe a little bit off the topic here, but I thought the Septuagint was translated by the 70...
No. The translation of the Torah, which is referred to as the Targum HaShivim, is translated, all of it's done by Jews. There's no question about it. But the translation of the Torah will refer to as the Targum HaShivim. The Septuagint includes all the books of Tanakh. I don't know specifically who did any of those. Even we assume the historicity of the story of the Targum HaShivim because it's told in many sources. But it is an attempt, and this actually is not part of the translation. This is added the way a Targum or a Midrash would add something. This is a set speech that's added to the translation. Why it's added for a very obvious reason is to make Esther behave the way you expect, a fine Jewish girl to behave in such a situation. And if you look at the Targum, it's exactly the same, except in the Targum she gets Ruach Nevuah, and she says, Rabbanu Shalom, don't hand me over to this uncircumcised one, present me favorably to Achashverosh, he shouldn't kill me, he should do my desire, have mercy on your people, do not hand over the sons of Jacob into the hands of Haman, Ben Havdasa, 14 more generations, Ben Agag, in full genealogy. It's obviously the Septuagint world and the Targum world are not the same. So I'm not going to argue, it's the same thing and one was reading the other. Of course not. But both of them felt a need at the very same point in the narrative to make make Esther do something appropriately Jewish at this critical point in the story. So again, it's a different kind of gap. It's the gap of somehow or other something Jewish is missing here. And both of these traditions, one which is probably certainly before the Common Era, the Septuagint, even if this is translated a little bit later, it's both translated in the first century BCE, and the other is probably 600-700 years later, both are responding in the same fashion. And finally, one example of a really interesting phenomenon, which will show us perhaps several different things. The Torah says in Mizarachalos Yitayla Havir LaMolech, you shall not give of your seed to hand over to Molech. The Mishnah says, and we'll start with the Mishnah and work back. The Mishnah says, anybody who says this as follows, you shall not give of your seed to impregnate an Aramean woman, we silence him harshly. It's a Mishnah in Megillah. Now, what is the first thing that you know when the Mishnah says, anybody who says this, we silence him harshly? Somebody's doing it, exactly.
when the kid says, I didn't break the cookie jar, the fact that you know is that the cookie jar is broken. So too, if you're told that anybody who says this, whatever, somebody is saying it. So let me ask you the following question. Why would anybody take that pasuk, and translate it and make it have something to do with intermarriage and impregnating non-Jewish women?
Because at this point, Molech is no longer
a threat. Molech is no longer a threat. I think you have to make that point. Molech worship is not a big deal.
No, that's the parsha deal with the similar subject.
Thank you! That's the parsha of Arayos. And it would be good if we had an issue against intermarriage. Yeah, I know that there's a pasuk that Chazal say deals with intermarriage, but if you're not willing to read Los Hischatein Bum, which refers to Shiva Amamin specifically, as referring to intermarriage generally, so maybe you do need a pasuk, right? We all know that intermarriage is awesome. The question is why. And so whoever decides to read this pasuk about that perhaps was not willing to expand the bum of Los Hischatein Bum to all non-Jews and was looking for a different... So those three things together, Molech is no longer a threat, the parsha is Arayos, and we need an issur for this, works. All right, so somebody's doing it. If you look in the Mishnah, the Gemara in Megillah on that, Tana de Rabbi Yishmael, Tana Rabbi Yishmael says that this verse is talking about a Jew who has intercourse with a non-Jewess and causes her to bear a child for idolatry. Rashi says, oh, Tana de Rabbi Yishmael is explaining the rejected view in the Mishnah. Other Rishonim aren't quite as, don't force it so much. In fact, Tana de Rabbi Yishmael is the rejected view of the Mishnah, basically. Because here you have it. But what's very interesting is this view is not invented in the time of the Mishnah, 200 CE, or any time around then, but this view is already found in that Book of Jubilees that I talked about earlier. Remember, that's written around at the time of the Chashmonaim, where you do have a problem of Hellenization and intermarriage and all kinds of cross-cultural stuff that we don't like. That was before Hanukkah, right, all right. And in the Book of Jubilees, after telling the story about Shimon and Levi and Dinah, and you see the whole passage there, and the part that's underlined is the relevant part. Now, anybody who's given over his daughter this way will be rooted out because he has given of his seed to Molech. Now, you realize that the interpretation is very cute, right? Zerah doesn't mean... child anymore, it means a semen. La'avir, which means to hand over, is interpreted as if it's from the rabbinic root ayin beis reish to impregnate, in word. And so you see how the drusha language is working. But at the same time, you see that the text that Chazal are rejecting is found already in the middle of the 2nd century BCE in a different group, maybe that's why Chazal are rejecting it, who are being very forceful and fierce, and the Book of Jubilees is terribly xenophobic and terribly anti-Gentile, and making a very, very strong argument using the very same pasuk that Chazal reflects the knowledge of this interpretation to. And what's really interesting, and I'll close with this, and just because it shows you that traditions, did Chazal know that they were quoting something that was in the Book of Jubilees? I don't know. But this tradition that Chazal say, anybody who says this, we shut him up harshly, is in your Mikros Gedolos. You open up Targum Yonasan on that pasuk, and Targum Yonasan on that pasuk reads, and it's there in English, it is, Uminzarach latitain with abara. I'm sorry, latitain betashmishta lefei bas amamin laabara lufulchana nuchraa. There it is. Tavernos in a few places preserves interpretations that Chazal in various places say you shouldn't do. Right? For whatever reason, it's a whole separate story why Tavernos comes into being the way it does, or exists the way it does. But it's there, and not only that, but in a Targum which was only published less than half a century ago, it's found in Kedoshim in the passage on Molech, the same thing. Any young or old male with intercourse with a woman from the daughters of the land. So what you see is that sometimes these very ancient interpretive traditions, even if they've been rejected explicitly by Chazal, still found a way of surviving in what we would call our standard rabbinic text. In other words, a mikros gedolo is off the shelf in shul. You don't expect to find something that Chazal say, oh no, you're not supposed to say that. But this is, again, this is a fairly unusual example, but because it's halachic, I wanted to show you that sometimes these things don't only deal with agadah, but they deal with halachic material as well. So just to pull it together in 30 seconds, what have we seen? We've seen a variety of kinds of texts which are all interpreting. Almost none of them we would call commentaries. They are all interpreting implicitly. They are all interpreting inferentially. You read it and you see what the interpretation is. And almost all of early interpretation down to the first or second century BCE was all of this type. It's only by the time, as I said, you get to the Midrashim, which are now formulated pasuk by pasuk, comment on a pasuk, that we get what we know as commentary. But the fact that we didn't have the commentary form didn't mean the commentaries weren't going on for a long time before that. Have a good one.
The kind of Hamilton debate is probably the